in this country, in 15 or 20 years' time, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
I don't call it ratting, I call it an insurrection.
The whites have become black. The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected.
This is not a racial problem. All we say is that we've got enough immigrants into the country, and that no more should be allowed in.
Welcome to About Race with Rennie Edo Lodge. In the aftermath of any kind of public conversation about racism, a question is born. It happens online and off. It happens between friends and between strangers. Here's a couple of examples from a quick browse of social media.
As a white person, what can I do to help race relations? What can I do as a white evangelical to help my brothers and sisters feel more accepted in a majority white church?
Now, my readers of colour are more concerned with how to cope, rather than with what to do. But what can I do is something that white readers ask me a lot. It was a question put to me last year by self-confessed posh podcasters, Pandora Sykes and Dolly Alderton, on their wildly popular podcast, The High-Low Show.
Welcome to episode 14 of The High-Low. It's now time for our first ever author special with Rennie Edo Lodge, who has now joined us in our studio.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming,
Dolly.
Yeah, thoughts. I'm going to be one of those awful, earnest white people that you talk about in that final chapter and ask the question that has probably been posed to you a million times, which is, what can we do as white people to help end racism? Because I know something that you say in that final chapter that really struck a chord is you said, there's no point white people wallowing in guilt and self-flagellation because that does absolutely nothing in terms of progression. So what would you say, what advice would you give?
Well, I don't know where you hold influence in your life. I don't know your friends. I don't know the extent of your jobs. I don't know where you can assess where the institutional racism is really taking hold in your sector and what you as individuals can attempt to do to change that. And so I'm in no position to tell you how you in both of your lives can attempt to try and change the problem. You know, I've spent many, many years thinking about this and fewer years writing about it. And I think that I've done a decent job of assessing the problem. But in terms of where you hold influence in your lives in order to attempt to overcome the problem, only you can diagnose that.
I know it comes from a good place, but I can't stand the what can I do question. I think the Queensland Aboriginal activist group put it best with this quote. If you've come here to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. It's all about solidarity.
I've actually always been quite annoyed at myself at how I phrased that question since we did the interview. It was in reference to a brilliant bit near the end of the book where Rennie describes how earnest white people ask her that question all the time and then gives some examples of how we can use our privilege to make change and call out racism. But I said it clumsily and I think I seemed demanding and imperious. I definitely learnt from it. I wouldn't ask that question again. And obviously it is important to highlight and to talk about this.
I don't think Dolly should be too hard on herself. I can understand why this question is asked. Taking on a huge global inequality is an intimidating prospect. Even just learning about it can be profoundly discomforting. So what can we do? There has to be something more productive than just arguing with people on the internet or wallowing in guilt. I asked two people who have decided to do something what they've learnt on their journeys. I don't think it's a coincidence that their work centres around one of the most urgent humanitarian failures of our time, the refugee crisis. Raed Khan's day job is in the music industry. He's also the founder of an organisation named Road to Freedom. We chatted over Skype.
Hello? Oh, hi, Reni. Sorry, I can hear you now.
How it started, I guess, was I just went into work as an every other day. It was in September 2015. And I was just reading like news articles and I happened to come across this image. It was a very disturbing image. And this, I've never taken it out of my head. It's always in my mind. And I always think of it when I'm, even on a day-to-day basis. It was of a three-year-old Syrian toddler named Alan Kurdi. And his body was washed up on a beach in Turkey. When I saw it at the time, I didn't think it was even real. I just thought maybe this is something like, maybe it's a movie scene. And then I started even thinking, are they even allowed to show children like dead like that in movies? And then when I started reading up about it, I was like, wow, this is like real life. Like, and then immediately I just felt stupid. Like, how can I not know that what's been happening? I ran out of the office. I rang my sister and just burst out crying in tears. Like, what is going on? And then she started educating me further that this has actually been happening since 2011 and telling me about the Arab Spring and people have been fleeing Syria, Iraq, all over, trying to get to Europe for safety. And I just felt honestly like an idiot. I just felt so stupid. I've been in my music industry bubble and when there's real stuff actually happening out there in the world. And I just asked her, like, how can we help? And then she told me that there was a camp in France called The Jungle, which I hate saying, but it was referred to as The Jungle when it existed at the time. And there are many, many people from all over Africa and Asia and the Middle East who are just living in these dire conditions. So we can help them. And after she said that, I literally started researching and put a GoFundMe link up for £1,000 to raise, to get the aid. And then once we hit the target in literally 24 hours, we purchased food items, sat there in my living room for a few days making the food parcels, and we head out to the camp and distributed it amongst the refugees. Just even growing up, when you see images like that, like, you just think, oh, I can never help. And just finding out that there's actually a camp literally next door to us, like in France, and like your people can go there and give them aid. And I was just thinking, why not? Like, why don't we instead of just thinking, oh, we can't really do anything to help these people, that some people are just like that in the world. And why not actually just be like, you know what, I'm just going to try and do something. And then going there and meeting them and be like, oh my God, just seeing, even just spending like a few hours with them and giving them the aid and just seeing that how much it helps, it just fueled it even further. Like, I was like, I'm never going to stop helping them. I don't want this to be just as a one-off good deed. So that's when Road to Freedom came about.
I was curious to know how many people Road to Freedom has reached.
I'm proud to say that not just me, but the whole entire team, that we've from fundraising to actually making passes to actually, I thank everyone, because the people we have reached is in the thousands of, and the countries we've visited, like, include like all over the Greek islands to mainland Greece, like Athens, Thessaloniki, to Serbia, to Macedonia, Germany, and now we've also started actually getting aid inside conflict zones in Somalia, as well as Syria, through teaming up with other charities who are on the ground. It was overwhelming at first, and the thing, even now, I'll always say that I wish I did really understand the sort of the magnitude of what I was entering at the time. But I don't regret it, because although there's been some very disturbing things I've seen, I'm kind of glad that I've really started to understand this is the reality of the world.
I asked Raed what he'd seen.
Things like just children with bullet wounds all over their bodies, like scars, amputee kids, just as when the borders closed, it was even hard because we were stopping suicides from happening. Just we met babies who were born on train tracks literally the day before, and we were actually on the abandoned train track on the border of Greece and Macedonia, giving them aid. The elderly just like so ill, but still traveling through countries, and this. After a while, like you take each story back with you when you get back home and you try to get on with your day-to-day job, and it's very difficult to just adapt back to your first world problems. You just left literally a refugee camp the night before.
I was curious to know if you'd seen racism affect this kind of aid work.
Yeah, I mean, the connotation of the jungle is like, it's ridiculous. And I'm not sure even where the term came from. It was from the sort of the racists and locals that were living in Calais. Or if it was sort of even the racist politicians in Calais, I'm not sure where it came from, but I mean, I always refuse to say it at the time, but in terms of even like when I see it in the media, people refer to it, it just really bothers me that they use that word. So we would be in with the camp in Calais. It was quite segregated in terms of what country you're from. They would have like their own sort of like sections and with the flag of the country that they're from in there. And when we would start going towards like the African countries, first they would look at me really like surprised that like why are you here? And I used to look back like, why are they giving me like a surprised look? And then I remember this man speaking to me and he's like, thank you for giving us the aid. And I looked at him like, of course, like don't say thank you at all. Like, why? And then he was like, oh, because many volunteers come over and they just from Europe and like America and Canada, they just want to help like the Syrians or the Iraqis. And it's like they choose who to give the aid to. And that really was very unsettling to hear that they just get overlooked. Because it's just disgusting that people could actually go there and just and choose and be selective of where the aid goes to. And that, yeah, I mean, that was really, 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 very tough to see that was happening inside the camps.
Raed is really passionate about respecting the humanity of those who have been displaced. And he wants that to be evidenced in the donations given to him for aid.
A weird donation or a crazy donation we've received in terms of like clothing. I mean, like from stilettos to like certain toys, which I can't mention on this podcast. I mean, I guess it's okay. Some people do see it as a thing where it's like it's an opportunity to clean out the cupboard and then put it in a bag and hand over. Although I really do appreciate the giving. But at the same time, it adds up more work for the volunteers as well as that. I wouldn't, and especially when there's a couple of like clothes that have holes or stains in them. I do put out there like, please. Like, we want to restore some dignity back to these people. Please give them what you would wear yourself. I mean, they were wearing better clothes than us before they fled their homes. They had even better lives than some of us. So, like, let's not try like take that away from them. And by just giving, it's still clothes, so they can wear it if it's got holes in them. I don't like that side of it. I think this sort of stuff does require long-term sort of commitment. I don't think me going there with, like, just like a food parcels, although it's needed at that time, there's more further, like I realized as well after the first year of doing it, the long-term support is really needed. Yeah, and I'm grateful that the charity is in a position now that we can sort of, like, provide that. I do disagree that it's great if you can come make food parcels, but don't just come to see what it's like for your own sort of like knowledge. They're not animals. It's not a zoo. They are humans and like they're fighting for survival. Like, please respect that and let, as I said before, restore some dignity back to them. When they queue up for food, they're very, very embarrassed. Some don't even look you in the eye when they take the food parcels off you. And they had beautiful lives before. They were doctors, they're nurses, they were dentists. They had like, they're very educated people. So any sort of misconceptions people have of refugees is like, they're not true. Like, they're exactly like you and me. Like, there's no difference. They're human.
So what does he think that we can do?
I think a lot of people forget that this is actually happening in Europe. This is like getting like a Ryanair and EasyJet flight out to like Germany, which is like, what, an hour and a half flight, or to Greece, which is a 3-hour flight. It's not that difficult. And what I do, and I always would advise anyone else who wants to go out to help people like in fleeing war, is make contact with charities on the ground, work with them. They know exactly, the situation is always changing. The needs are always changing. There's not always the same, especially it was very noticeable when the borders were open and then when Europe closed their borders, the situation changed drastically and even the needs. So in the beginning, it was immediate aid, but now it's more sort of long term, like in terms of like where when they need accommodation, they need like medical support, they need legal advice. So it's even the charities sort of adapted to the needs of the refugees. I always say, do your research, like before you even, if it involves like heading out to places, do your research before you go. Make contact with other people that are doing similar things there already, or team up with people. Like, strength in numbers always. Don't ever think that you want your voice or is not strong enough. Like, I when I first started, I genuinely, when I was crying at my desk after seeing the picture, I had no clue that this was going to turn into something that will impact my entire life, my family, my friends' life. I'm going to continue to do this until the day that I die. I had no clue that I would be, or anyone else even cared, until I put it out there. And everyone who's came to help has helped. And if you really believe in it, it will happen. And you can make a change.
I first came across Gabby Edlin's work via the feminist community. Her charity, Bloody Good Period, strikes at the intersection of feminism, migration, race, and injustice.
Bloody Good Period collects period supplies for asylum seekers and refugees, and we distribute them to around 13 drop-in centres in London and Leeds.
It seems a bit niche, period supplies. How did this come about?
So I think the very reason because it seems niche is why I set it up. I was volunteering at an asylum seeker drop-in centre, and it became apparent that they weren't collecting period supplies. And I don't think it was through any sort of active discrimination or, you know, refusal to sort of look after women, but I think it was very much something that we just don't talk about and it just hadn't been considered. And so when I asked if that was something that we should be collecting, I was told, oh, we do, but, you know, we give them out in an emergency or we give them out when the women ask for them. Both of those scenarios just appalled me because I thought the first point is, what does an emergency look like? Does someone have to bleed on the floor for you to take them seriously and give them a sanitary towel? And the second one about it being, you know, women going up and asking for them. A woman might ask for one once, but she's not going to go every single month and say, can I have another pad? Sorry, can I have another pad? And in addition to that, a lot of asylum seekers, because of the trauma they've been through, report having really heavy periods or really irregular periods. So it's obviously something that is on people's minds constantly, but isn't being something that's taken care of, because I think we see the person who needs help or the sort of aid victim, in inverted commas, as a default male. And I think that is how we've been operating at these drop-in centres. So I see period supplies as essential as food.
I asked Gabby why she took up this cause.
As a Jewish woman, a lot of our community and ancestry is sort of rooted in asylum and people being moved around from place to place. And so it's really important for me and for my friends and family to be making sure that the people who are going through this now get our support, because we will have, you know, my grandparents, my great grandparents will have benefited from the support of Britain, I hope. You know, how much I don't know, but I feel like it's incredibly important. And also I believe in a right to safety, and it doesn't even feel like a political belief. It just feels like the right thing to do. But I guess it is a political belief that I believe that everybody who is seeking asylum needs to be given a fair understanding and a way of living that is fair and considered and not as some sort of punished prisoner. And so the synagogue that I was helping at with the drop-in centre just felt like the right thing to do. And then obviously my real, like, fundamental belief in gender equality, and that there were just these women whose basic human rights were not being taken care of, or not being considered, maybe not taken care of, but not being considered. They weren't receiving any extra money. You know, asylum seekers are on £37 a week and that is it. They're not allowed anything else. There's no recourse to public funds. They're not allowed to work. Their volunteering time is even limited. So to spend, you know, if you have a really heavy period, to spend around £10 a month, if not more, probably more, £20 a month on pads, it's just going to be something that just gets left to the bottom of the pile.
How did you go about, in a practical way, setting up what has now become Bloody Good Period?
All I did, the initial thing, was I put a post on Facebook, not even a public post. It was literally to my friends and family saying, I'm collecting pads for this asylum seeker drop-in. Can anyone send me them? I set up an Amazon wish list and they just came flooding in. I expected to get, I mean, my dad gave me a tenner to buy some. Like, I thought that was what it was going to be like. I thought it was going to be people like, just a one-off, like, oh yeah, that sounds like a really lovely thing, you know. But it really just took off, and like, I had thousands of pads in my flat by the end of the month, and like, that was sort of how it just continued. It was just a Facebook post. And then obviously I think I started to realise it was becoming something, and it could become something that could have an impact. So that's when I started branding it and really sort of thinking about like the core message that I wanted Bloody Good to have. It started up pretty rapidly. So it's been going over a year, and then this year will become a charity properly, which is quite exciting.
Do you know like the number of women that you've provided period products to since then?
I think it's around 2,000. But then we also give to men as well. So we do provide toiletries as well. So that's probably another 1,000. And then there's children too. So we'll do like children's toothbrushes and stuff. I think all in all, we probably give to about 2,500 people a month.
I was interested in knowing how the charity avoids being patronising to the people that they serve.
We've been working on our constitution for the charity, and we were sort of talking about how do we name the people who receive the products, and we were like, well, they're not beneficiaries because we don't get to say if they benefit. You know, in some of the drop-ins, they're called clients. That's quite nice and is also just so much more respectful than, I don't know, like victims or something that I've heard, other types of things that I've heard before, victims of period poverty. We just say the people we work with, and it is very much with. We listen to what they ask us. It's a very much a case of, you tell me what you want, we're going to do our best to get it. And actually, the products that we've been receiving and purchasing now are almost completely different from a year ago. You know, even just with sanitary towels alone, people were sending well-meaningly really cheap ones because you could get more. But actually, the women then started, as they felt more comfortable around us, started saying that actually these are a bit rubbish. Like, oh, I was getting a rash from this one. And, you know, taking sort of the more established brands and saying like, actually, you know, these are the ones I prefer.
I've noticed a kind of paternalistic attitudes towards asylum-seeking women from those of us with secure migration status. I asked Gabby what she's had to deal with in that area.
So obviously menstrual cups are a really popular product with the community of people who donate. So obviously we...
Who's that community?
A feminist community, a middle-class feminist community probably as well. And, you know, that is where sort of the menstrual cup popularity lies. I use one myself. You know, I'm a fan of it, but it took me a long time to get used to it and a lot of coaching from friends and family. And there's a sort of cup evangelist vibe with them that people really believe that they are the best thing you could possibly give. And so people started both sending them to me and emailing me quite aggressively saying, why haven't you just done this? Why don't you give these to the women that you work with? They're so much better for them. They're so much cheaper. But I mean, I just suddenly, you know, I was trying very hard to be like, okay, yeah, well, we'll try and give them to them. But actually, we have like 1 minute with the people at the drop-in. You know, it's really quick. And I don't think they appreciate me coming over to them and saying, listen, let's talk about this product that we think is better for you. It doesn't matter if it saves them money. If it makes them feel uncomfortable because we're expecting something of them that not all of us would even expect of ourselves, I don't think that's the right way to be. Actually, our priority is making sure that they're comfortable and that they're happy with what they've got. And the worst situation would be for somebody to take home a cup out of feeling like they should and actually either just chucking it out or really struggling with it.
There's a few things that you need access to use a cup.
Absolutely. You need boiling water.
You need privacy. You need clean running water.
A lockable toilet.
Mm-hmm.
You also need a really good relationship with your vagina. And not everybody does. And a lot of the women that we work with have had sexual trauma. Some have had FGM. It's not really fair for us to expect everybody to have the same sort of easy relationship with their genitals that we might have in a privileged world.
You need to be living somewhere where you can comfortably boil your menstrual cup.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's simple as
even
that.
Even people working lucrative 9-to-5 jobs are sometimes not in the position where they can be like, oh, hi everyone, I'm just boiling my cup in the
yeah
on the hob or putting it in the dishwasher.
Yeah, like. Exactly. And like, you need to be able to have, you'd be like, this is the bathroom is mine for an hour. You know, nobody's knocking on that door. Hmm. Nobody's getting cross with me. You know, you need to be like, not afraid that if it spills, you're like, your landlord's going to come in and tell you off for being unhygienic because you've got menstrual blood on the floor. You need to be very, very comfortable in all of these situations for it to be an option. And I think that it's just really got to be something that people think about before they evangelize about the best thing for what the women are. Like, actually chat to the women, find out. We say, what is it you like? Oh, we want the thick pads. Great, that's what you're having. We're going to get you that. And that's sort of all that really matters, I think.
Another interesting side to this is the fact that Gabby isn't black, yet the vast majority of the women that she works with are.
Issues with shampoo have definitely come up. And that's actually was a really quick and steep learning curve for me, because as a white woman, I had no clue that 2-in-1 shampoos do not work for Afro hair.
And most, also like the shampoo and conditioner all in one.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And basically the ones that we could get off Amazon in bulk.
And this is a problem because the majority of the women who you're giving the products to are not white.
No, right? They're not. Yeah, mostly. I think it's about 70% are not white. You know, it didn't occur to me, and I'm embarrassed to admit that. And I didn't even sort of ask my friends about it because I hadn't even thought about the fact that it wasn't, you know, it's actually just sort of a bit of a parallel to the sanitary towels because I just hadn't thought about it. So one of the women that, after over a year that we'd been giving out these like pretty average shampoos, said to me, you know, we could do with this shea butter. And I was just like, oh, you idiot, Gabby. Like, they've been taking it every month because they've been made to feel as asylum seekers that they don't get to ask for the things that they deserve. And what's the point in giving someone something that's just either just going to get chucked or is just going to make them feel worse about themselves? So really quickly, we've started to implement much more demand for Afro hair products. And we're still sort of, there's nothing like a pushback, but it's still, I think, shifting people's perceptions of, whereas you might have sent the pads that you like and the pads that you feel familiar with, and that's something that you enjoy sending, actually take a bit of time to check what the best products are. I mean, people do send us half empty toiletries sometimes, and I find that really, really upsetting.
Why do you think they're doing that?
Because people are selfish occasionally. I should say the amount of amazing donations we have is incredible, and people are brilliant. And I think everybody who already is familiar with Bloody Good will know that they're not that person that I'm talking about. But yeah, we get half empty toiletries because people think it's a dumping ground.
Right.
I think there is still this white saviorism in many of us that thinks that whatever we give, they will be grateful for. And that is a really toxic way of thinking. You know, it still happens from really well-meaning people who really think the best thing for these women is this stuff that I use. The best thing for these women is this. I think it's better. I would rather they used these products. And it just shows an utter lack of respect. You should not have to feel grateful for any of these things. And sometimes we do get asked, like, you know, what's the response from, you know, the people at your table, at your sanitary towel table, as though it should be like, oh, thank God you thought of me. And it's not. And if it was ever like that, it would be embarrassing. It needs to be that you pick it up because that's what you do. That's what you do in Boots. That's what you do in Superdrug. You don't go crying to the till in Superdrug saying, thank God you thought of me. And I think that is something that we really need to start really trying to crush in this activism sector, that especially in sort of aid and in charity, is that you're lucky for getting anything at all.
Gabby and Raed might seem like exceptional individuals, but I think what they've done is actually very much within all of our reach. They've started small-scale movements. Setting up something is a part of being something bigger. They're two ordinary people who incorporate an anti-racist perspective into their wider work, proving that you don't need loads of money and it doesn't need to be your full-time job. Joining an already existing group is a good idea if setting up something from scratch isn't an option for you. But the joining is easy. Ensuring that the group is effective is another task altogether. I spoke about this to Matthew Bolton, the Deputy Director of Citizens UK.
Basically, I'm a campaigner and an organiser and a writer, and I'm really all about trying to give people the tools so they've got some power to change the things that they feel angry about.
What's community organising?
It's a social change method. It's like an approach to trying to make a difference. Barack Obama was probably like the person that's made it most famous. He was an organiser before he trained to be a lawyer. But community organising's got a kind of heritage in the States and here. It's the method itself kind of comes from a combination of civil rights activist campaigning methods with trade union, kind of migrant trade union organising. It's got a heritage, which is basically about how do people get together and take on decision makers and try and win the things that they want.
You might already be aware of the organisation's hugely successful Living Wage campaign. The ask is simple. It calls on employers to pay their staff enough to live on. When the campaign started in 2001, the national minimum wage was just £3.70 an hour. Since then, the campaign has won political support, changed legislation, and seen over 2,800 businesses commit to paying their staff a living wage.
we've never made any progress without people who have a lot to lose stepping up and speaking out. So whether that's the cleaner in the bank, you know, who challenges the chairman at the AGM and calls out the injustice of the pay, or the cleaner who leaves a letter on the desk of the Secretary of State asking for a meeting, you know, they're risking their jobs. Sometimes they're risking even more than that in terms of their family and rent and house and everything. But they do it in the context of a collective. So we're not just asking one person to speak out, although the newspaper story is of the one person, because that's the heroic story of change. They do that in the context of a campaign that's going to back them up if they get in trouble, and has got the backing of like a community alliance that will fight for that issue.
Matthew wrote this little book about community organising called How to Resist. There was one section of it that really resonated with me. And I think a lot of us who wonder, what can I do, could do with considering it. What is the iron rule?
The iron rule is the hardest part of the community organising rule book. It's the only real thing that is supposed to be a rule, because the rest of the method, you know, you try and build power and make a difference, it's quite flexible and you apply it in different ways. But the iron rule basically says never do for others what they can do for themselves. And it's a counterbalance to that kind of do-gooding, paternalistic approach to trying to solve problems for people, you know. And you can see it in so much of the charity sector and the political narrative where it's like, oh, you know, look at these poor people with their needs and their deprived communities, and us experts here are going to figure out what intricate tax credit solution will try and make their situation better. And whereas the justice response to that is to say, actually, if these people had more power, what is it that they could do for themselves, and how do you equip them to make the change? And for example, the Living Wage campaign, which isn't about some expert somewhere figuring out a better approach to tax credits. It's about saying people who work hard deserve to earn enough to live. And not only that, they can fight for that change themselves. It's trying to stop that sense of like, you know, we're the experts and we're going to do it for you, and actually turn it on its head and say, how do people have the power and voice to actually make the change they want?
You called it the justice approach. Can you expand on that?
I mean, I suppose justice as opposed to maybe kind of mercy and charity and kind of experts and beneficiaries and clients and customers. You know, there's so much of that language is the power imbalance is built into it. You know, that you're the client or the customer or the service user or the beneficiary, and we're somehow the people who are going to help you. We did some work in Calais in the jungle camps with the refugee children, and everybody wanted to donate things that they thought people would need. And sometimes they weren't even the right things, because loads of baby clothes went out there, but there were no babies. People wanted to donate things. They wanted to help in that way. But actually, you know, why were they there? They were there because they were fleeing from persecution and they desperately wanted to come and find safety here. And just kind of giving them another blanket isn't actually going to solve the problem in the long term. You know, whereas in the case of this Safe Passage campaign, it was about, basically, we're taking the government to court right now over their failure to allow people in safely through this Dublin regulation. So there was actually a justice solution for their problem. It's just that the people in power weren't allowing it to be used.
That's a really interesting example, because that suggests to me some sort of critical analysis happened to work out what those child refugees couldn't do for themselves, rather than responding to their immediate crisis situation.
Yeah, and it wasn't from like a kind of policy research point of view either. It was actually from simply asking them what they wanted, as opposed to what do we think they ought to want.
And also there's a flip in responsibility there, I think, because, you know, of course my work is very, very different and I've never been a child refugee, but sometimes I feel in the what can I do question, it is a tell me what to do so that I can absolve myself of responsibility from the situation.
Quick disclaimer here. I think it's about absolving responsibility and taking on responsibility. Asking me is the way to show sympathy, but also a way to deflect your own power to change things.
Right. What do they want to do? And why do they want to do it? Where's it coming from? Why are they asking that question? That should really be the beginning of what they then do, rather than you telling. I guess that's true. Yeah, who are you to tell loads of people what they ought to do? It's a strange So well, what do you say when they
ask? I always say, I don't want to be prescriptive. Yeah. I don't know you and your life. I don't know where you hold influence. I don't know your resources. I don't know your skills. I can't tell you what to do. It's an awkward one, I think. But I think that if we care enough and we start doing the work around it, then we can all feel empowered to do something.
Yeah, and I think you're right about the individualization of it. It's like, what can they, if they're not part of something which is trying to make a difference on the things they care about, they should probably join it. Individuals on their own can't make that much difference. I mean, if they end up with a big platform and a lot of people kind of following them and listening to what they say, they can. But for most people, the ability to make change comes from the fact that you're part of some collective, you joined an organization. And I think you're right that there is a growing sense of this kind of individualization and suspicion of organizations, you know, either they're not effective or their motives or something. But yeah, I mean, basically you need to join something.
Join something. Start something. What it might be, I don't know. But I'm drawn again to this quote that I mentioned at the beginning of this episode. If you've come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you've come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. An interesting fact. This quote from the Queensland Aboriginal activist group is often attributed to the activist Lilla Watson. But she's since said that she's uncomfortable with the way it's been individualised. It wasn't just her that came up with this quote. It was a collective process. I can't think of a better reason to keep working together. This week, I'm going to signal boost the podcast Blacticulate, which is a really fascinating conversation with young black entrepreneurs, people who start their own businesses, or even just people with particular skills. If you're interested in audio production, you should definitely listen to the episode in which the presenter Ade speaks to Renee, who's a producer on this podcast. Yes, I know our names are similar, you don't need to point it out to me. So if you'd like to know how to produce a podcast, definitely listen to that episode. But check the whole series out, it's really good. This is the final episode of About Race with Rennie Edo Lodge. Thank you for all your listens, downloads, and social media conversations. The support has been incredible. If a series 2 comes to be, the first place you'll hear about it will be on my social media pages. You can find me on Twitter at RennieRennie, my Instagram is at RennieEdoLodge, and my website is rennieedolodge.co.uk. You can find full transcripts of every episode, as well as information on all the books we've discussed on aboutracepodcast.com. Oh, and the book I wrote, the one that I've been mentioning throughout this series, is Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. You can find it in all good bookshops. Special thanks to those who've made this podcast series what it is: Renee Richardson, Rez Marino, Kevin Morosky, Matt Sedisho, and Isis Thompson. Thank you all for listening.